From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. At the center of Meg Wolitzer's new novel, The Position, is sex. How it shapes our lives, and how baffling, embarrassing, or transcendent it can be. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Meg Wolitzer about her novel. The New Yorker magazine says Wolitzer's comic timing never wavers, and she has an astute grasp of the way one generation's liberation inspires the next generation's pity. Also, we remember a man who survived a lynching in 1930 and went on to create America's Black Holocaust Museum. James Cameron died this week at age 92. And David Edelstein reviews two films in theaters today, Nacho Libre and The Lake House. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Meg Wolitzer's novel, The Position, has just been published in paperback. The story begins in 1975, when four children, ages 6 to 15, discover a book written by their own parents called Pleasuring, One Couple's Journey to Fulfillment. It's a manual, kind of like The Joy of Sex, illustrated with sketches of the couple demonstrating the various positions. Wolitzer's novel follows these characters over the next three decades, as the couple divorces and ages, and the children grow up and form their own relationships. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan wrote, "By its end, The Position turns out to be a poignant elegy to the fleeting health and pleasures of the body, as well as to the fleeting emotional and physical togetherness of the family." Meg Wolitzer's other books include Sleepwalking, Surrender Dorothy, and The Wife. Terry Gross spoke with Wolitzer last year. Let's start with a reading from the opening of The Position.
The book was placed on a high shelf in the den, as though it were the only copy in the world, and if the children didn't find it, they would be forever unaware of the sexual lives of their parents, forever ignorant of the press of hot skin, the overlapping voices, the stir and scrape of the brass headboard as it lightly battered the plaster, creating twin finial-shaped depressions over the years in the wall of the bedroom in which the parents slept or didn't sleep, depending on the night. The book sat among a collection of unrelated and mostly ignored volumes, Watership Down, Diet for a Small Planet, Building a Deck for Your Home, Yes, I Can, The Story of Sammy Davis Jr., The Big Anthology of Golden Retrievers, and on and on and on. It was casually slipped in, this one copy of the book that the parents brought into the house, for if they'd stored all their copies, including the various foreign editions, in taped-up boxes in the basement marked kitchenware or odds and ends, that would have sent a message to the children. Sex is filth. Or at least, if not exactly filth, then something unacceptable to think about anywhere except beneath a blanket, in pitch darkness, between two consenting, loving, lusty, faithful, married adults. This, of course, was not the view of the parents, who for a very long time had loved sex and most of its aspects, loved it so dearly that they'd found the nerve and arrogance to write a book about it. When they thought of their four children reading that book, though, they brooded about what kind of effect it would have on them over time. Would it simply bounce off their sturdy, sprouting bodies, or else be absorbed along with the fractions and canned spaghetti and skating lessons, the things that wouldn't last, wouldn't matter, or perhaps would matter, coalescing into some unimaginable shape and gathering meaning inside them? But the parents' concern was mostly overshadowed by confidence. So why not put the book on a shelf in the den, a high but reachable shelf where the children could get to it if they wanted to? And the chances were good that they would want to, and that no one would be struck dead by it, and life would just go on as it always had.
That's Meg Wolitzer reading from the beginning of her new novel, The Position. Of course, Meg, after the children do discover this book, life does not go on the way it always had. It really changes all of their lives. And I'm wondering what made you think about having this sex manual at the center of a book, and thinking about what the consequences might be for the children if the parents had written a sex manual.
Well, for me, reading The Joy of Sex when I was a kid was a pivotal moment. My sister and I took my parents' copy and went off and read it. And the thing that struck us at the time was that this couple, he looked kind of like Kris Kristofferson, Alan Bates, the sort of bearded look that was popular at the time.
Yeah.
And she was kind of closer to my mother's age than mine. It could be your parents. I mean, there was something about this couple that was adult, and it kind of gave you a little bit of an aperture into the world of adult sexuality, ready or not.
Excuse me for sounding dumb, but I actually never read The Joy of Sex.
Oh, well, you must.
Is it actually like photographs of people?
It's drawings.
It's drawings, like in the sex manual in your book.
Yeah.
Now, your mother is a writer, Hilma Wolitzer. And yes. I'm wondering, like, when you were young, did you come across sex scenes of hers? And what impact did that have on you?
Yes, that had an impact as well. I mean, these things all kind of came together in my mind to gestate for a long time until I wrote The Position. But when I was a teenager, in junior high school, actually, my mother sold her first novel, Ending, and it was a wonderful literary book, but it did have a pretty graphic sex scene in it. And I remember going to school that day, and a bunch of boys had a copy of the book, and they ran down the hallway shouting, "Read page 108, read page 108. And I pretty much went home to my mother and said, "Why couldn't you be a travel agent?" In the suburb where we lived, nobody's mother was a novelist. Everybody's mother was a travel agent or a real estate agent or a housewife. This was something pretty unusual that she did.
You know, so when the children discover the sex manual that their parents wrote and illustrated, it's not only kind of embarrassing and unsettling for them, It's also kind of baffling. Like one of the sons, Michael says, or Michael thinks, apparently no one could ever get enough of sex. It needed to be replenished again and again, filled up like a bucket in a well. It wasn't enough for people simply to have sex with each other. They also had to examine pictures of it and read about it and hear it described in agonizing and exhilarating detail. Do you think it would be baffling to a child finding one of these books to think, like, why do they have to be so absorbed in it? Why don't have to, like, read about it and write about it? And
yeah, because up to a certain age, it just simply seems disgusting. You know, I guess that's called latency, the period at which it really would kind of seem like this animalistic thing that has nothing to do with you. But of course, one day it will have everything to do with you. And I think maybe some part of your mind realizes that when you see it and you're appalled.
Now, one way of thinking about the impact such a sex book would have on the children of the parents who wrote it is that it would be sexually liberating, because it would mean they were growing up in a sexually open environment, that they got a good education from sneaking a peek at the book. But the book really becomes a burden to most of the children in your novel. And then as they grow up, this may or may not relate to the existence of the book, but as they grow up, they each have their own sexual issues. One of them is on antidepressants, and that's made him less sexually responsive and more sexually frustrated. One of the sons is gay, and nothing in the book speaks to his condition. And one of the daughters feels so unattractive, she doesn't think anyone would ever think of her as sexual. And I just find it really interesting the way you use sex in the book to get at character and to get at how people's lives are shaped, the things that shape them, the way they turn out.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to use sex as the kind of organizing principle around the book?
Well, I wanted sex to sort of heighten all of the emotional drama in the book about childhood and growing up and coming into your own. I realized that I couldn't think of a book that dealt with the uncomfortable relationship between sex and family. Here we all are in a family, and the adults are sexual, and the kids are secretly becoming sexual and have to hide their feelings about sex and their experiences, and everyone's living under one roof. This is all going on, but for the most part, unless you're in one of those real, you know, hippie families that I did know of, it's not really discussed. So using sex essentially as a kind of catalyst or as a bomb, really, to sort of show how it's sort of too much exposure to sex in this family, the Mellow family, who I invented, sets off a lifetime of feeling. I think it just heightens what was already there. You know, Claudia, the younger daughter, who wants to stay trapped in childhood because her parents were the sexual ones. She feels so unattractive that she's saving her money as a child in a Pillsbury Doughboy bank, hoping to save it up so that maybe someday she can pay a man to love her. You know, sex belongs to the parents, not to her.
One of the things you get at in your novel is the reality of sex as compared to the way it's presented in romantic literature and erotic movies. And the reality of sex is different. What are some of the differences you want to get at in the book?
Well, it's often awkward. I mean, speaking from personal experience and from discussions with others, but you don't really read that very often. It's a kind of navigation between people. If they're new to each other, there's a kind of shyness or awkwardness. There's a certain stylization that we see in so much of the media about sex. And in this book, each of the children, as they grow up, has to kind of find their way in the world of sex, that the parents really trailblazed before them. And the illustrations of the parents actually making love, the illustrations were so, you know, beautiful and done in pen and ink so elegantly. How can the kids live up to that? How can any of us live up to that? Things go wrong. People fall off beds. Bodies don't fit. You know, all kinds of things happen in real life.
Well, one of the great things in your book is that the parents, the couple whose illustrations are in the book, in other words, the book has illustrations of them making love, this couple doesn't live up to their own illustrations. Let me just read another passage here. And this is basically about how absurd and silly looking the reality of sex can be. You know, at first this couple thinks that they should take pictures of themselves in the positions that they want to discuss in the sex manual. So they set up a camera on a tripod with a timer, and then the woman, the wife, looks at the photos, and here's what she thinks. As far as she was concerned, she was all double chin and breast, and Paul was a shapeless Monet haystack of body hair. Everything unattractive was accentuated, and everything at all appealing seemed to have been airbrushed out. Their bodies joined together in standard missionary sex looked grotesque, their faces screwed up in pain and courage, as though the act in which they were partaking was excruciating and required a sort of personal heroism in order to endure it.
Well, the idea of a book of pictures of you having sex is so horrible that I might have to faint right now even thinking about it. You don't mind if I do. I just think that that's the truer version of sex, really, if we're not Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. You know, we're these human beings. And coming upon a book of your parents having sex in various positions, and I would like to say that the parents invent a position which they wanted to kind of give their book a certain cachet. And I really wanted to come up with the worst sort of 70s name that I could. And I spent a lot of time on this, and I came up with the name Electric Forgiveness. So the parents come up with some ridiculous position called that.
Meg Wolitzer speaking with Terry Gross. We'll get back to their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Meg Wolitzer, author of the novel The Position. It's just been published in paperback.
Meg, in order to write this book, you had to write about sex. And there isn't really all that much writing about the actual act, but there is some of it. And I'm wondering what it was like for you to get comfortable writing in a, you know, semi-explicit way about sexuality.
It took me a long time. I think that I look at my career over, you know, as this book and the last book, The Wife, I think are part of a sort of newer period for me and the period that I'm most interested in. I heard once long ago in a writing workshop, and I'm sure it's a famous line, write as though everyone you know were dead. And I think that's really the way to go. I mean, if you're writing for an audience, or if you're writing because you know your mother's going to read it and what will she say, what are you doing? Why are you writing? It's not that anything in here, in fact, is anything my mother of all people, would be upset by. But you start off writing to please someone. You start off writing to please your teacher or your mother or a friend or a lover. And then you have to abandon that, and you have to write what you want to write about. I started to think that men had been bolder sometimes writing about some of these issues. Philip Roth is a writer I've always loved. And he just doesn't seem to care what people think. And I found myself stuck in a kind of writing class lyricism that I was getting upset about, in which there was very little drama and momentum, and I wanted to write more about things that mattered to me, about big things between people, and one thing between people is sex. And in this book, I wanted to sort of write about a kind of array of sexual lives.
What are some of the things you had to figure out in coming up with the right tone and language to actually write the more explicitly sexual parts of the book?
Well, you know, it seems to me that writing about sex is hard to do and usually pointless because we've all had sex. What are you going to tell me that's new? Are you telling me this to titillate me? I mean, I'm not Anais Nin. I don't want to do one of those Anais Nin Henry Miller jags. That's not what I'm after here. So if there was going to be a sex scene, it had to have a reason to be. I had to say to myself, why are you telling me this? And in each case, with the different characters, sex had a meaning that propelled the story forward and also gave us information about who they were.
As we've mentioned, your mother, Hilma Wolitzer, is a novelist, too. We talked a little bit about the impact of reading a sex scene in her book when you were young. But I'm interested in the broader impact it had on you to read your mother's books. At what age did you become interested in actually reading what your mother had written?
Very early, because I don't think I really understood it. Her first short story, which was published in the old Saturday Evening Post, back when they ran fiction, was called Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket. And I seem to remember that it had a drawing of a woman in a supermarket with a very white face, putting her hand over her face. And for about a minute, I worried whenever we went to King Cullen that my mother was going to have a kind of breakdown in the market because I didn't understand what fiction was. But I got it as time went on. I mean, books and reading was so much a part of my relationship with her. We cried together over Charlotte's Web. When I saw her writing, I don't think I respected it at first. I mean, I would leave the house in the morning to go to school, and she'd be sitting there in a bathrobe with her hands poised above the keyboard of a Smith Corona. And I'd come home at the end of the day, and she'd be there in that bathrobe with her hands poised above the keyboard of the Smith Corona. And I wanted to say, you know, pull yourself together, woman. What is it to be a writer? It's a slow process of acceptance on the part of a child to realize that your parent is really doing something wonderful, being an artist. It was tremendously exciting. But again, kids do want their parents to be a little bit boring. And she had enough of that suburban stuff, making, salads in the shape of a girl's face and going on field trips, so that it wasn't like she was so bohemian. She really wasn't. I think that being around a writer when you're a child can be, can be bad sometimes. My children, I think, sometimes wish that I did something else. Years ago, when my son was little, we were walking past a McDonald's, and there was a sign that said, now hiring. And he got all excited and said, look, Mom, look, maybe, you could do this on the side. He wanted regular hours for me. He wanted a life that seemed stable. And I had to say to him, this is what you've got. I'm sorry. And I think that they've come to see that it's unusual and can be fun sometimes.
You know how, like, when you read a book by someone you know, you look to see, is any character based on you? Are there any secret messages here regarding how this writer actually feels about you?
Yeah.
So when you were reading, like, books by your mother, did you look for clues about how she really felt about you?
Oh, yes. In fact, there was a short story that she wrote, one of her early short stories in the New American Review, this wonderful literary magazine in the 60s and 70s. And the character, a young unhappy mother again, is sitting on the side of a bathtub washing her son's hair. And she thinks, I don't love you, kiddo. And I remember reading that and feeling some kind of deep pang. But how could it be possible? She had just worked all night on my costume for Peter Pan. How could it be possible? It can't be possible, which I think gave me a sort of early understanding, a precocious understanding of the way writers make things up. But I think the way ideas come about is so sort of circumlocuous. It doesn't come directly. You don't have to not love your child in order to write that scene. But everyone is filled with ambivalence, and that's really hard for kids to see, that their mother is ambivalent, is not just an all-good, benign cookie baker, has some dark moments, has some muttering times. And I think as kids get older, they see that that's okay. I began to love it and to really respect it in my mother that she was interesting, that she had this sort of wonderful talent that seemed to come out of nowhere. Back then she was called a housewife turned novelist, as though she'd done this incredible transformation freakishly. It was so amazing to reviewers that a housewife could write a novel.
We talked a little earlier about the impact that this sex manual has on the children in the novel as they grow up. And we talked a little bit about what it was like when you were a girl to find that your mother had written a novel with a sex passage in it. You have two children. How will you feel when they read your book? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, it's come up a little bit. My 14-year-old son has asked if he could read it. And first I said no. And then I thought, oh, I see. The more I say no, the more I'm going to turn this into a hot object in some way. And I don't want to do that. I said to him, well, you know, I think you would enjoy other books of mine more. This one has some sex in it. I think it might be embarrassing to you. And then the conversation just sort of ended a little bit. I mean, I think the thing that always strikes me as funny is that the children of writers aren't all that interested, for the most part, in their mother or father's work. They're sort of interested in their own lives a lot more. But when they do kind of look up from their own self-absorption now and again, and they ask about it, I bring it up as a they bring it up as a possibility, and I sort of respond in a kind of vague way, which is not unlike the way the parents in my book sort of responded. They left the book around for the children to see. Now, I'm not an exhibitionist, and this book doesn't feature pictures of me having sex in it, but I think that it's important that he know that it's a novel and that this comes from the imagination, because I think that that's the thing that's kind of falling away, the idea that a book you can write is made up and that it's not a true thing, that it's fiction and it's a work of the imagination and their mother is really proud of it. But I certainly wouldn't, you know, ban it.
Meg Wolitzer, thanks so much for talking with us.
No, thank you.
Meg Wolitzer speaking with Terry Gross last year. Wolitzer's novel, The Position, has just been published in paperback. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greatergood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we listen back to an interview with a man who survived a lynching and went on to establish America's Black Holocaust Museum. James Cameron died this week at age 92. Also, reviews of two new films, The Lake House and Nacho Libre. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. On a hot summer night in 1930, 16-year-old James Cameron was nearly lynched in Marion, Indiana, by a mob of Ku Klux Klansmen and their sympathizers. Cameron was sent to jail, charged with a murder and rape he did not commit. He was sentenced to 2 to 21 years and served 4. In 1993, Indiana Governor Evan Bayh granted Cameron a full pardon. This week, James Cameron died at the age of 92, after a long illness. James Cameron founded America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee in 1988. One photograph in that museum is of the mob in Marion, standing under Mr. Cameron's two black friends hanging from a tree. It became one of the most infamous and most reproduced American lynching scenes. Guest host Marty Moscoane interviewed Cameron in 1994 when his book A Time of Terror was published. They spoke about what happened that August night in 1930. James Cameron told her he was riding in a car with two young men he knew from the neighborhood, Thomas Shipp and Abraham Smith. Smith said they wanted to rob someone. This is what happened next.
Well, I wanted to get out of the car. I didn't want to have anything to do with them. So they kept on driving. They wouldn't stop the car. And we drove out to a place past the 38th Street Bridge and the Soldiers' Home and down a lane called Lover's Lane. And there we came across an automobile that had been parked on the sidelines, and there was a man and a woman in the back seat. Now, on the way to this car from Thomas's car, I had a feeling of something inside me saying, go back, go back, go back. But I kept following them as if I was tied to them. I don't know what it was that drove me. Maybe it was the idea that I wanted to show them that I was as brave as they were or what. But I kept right on following them as if I was tied to them. We came to this car, and they pulled a gun out from their pocket. Thomas had the gun in his bib overalls, and he handed it to Abe, and Abe handed it to me and said, here, you hold him up. And foolishly, I walked up to the car. I said, stick him up. And the people got out of the car, and I noticed the man when he got out, and I noticed the woman when she got out. Her face was pale and lovely and frightened. And as soon as the man got out of the car, I recognized him immediately. He was a friend of mine.
Someone, you had a shoeshine stand.
Yeah, I was his shoeshine boy. He was a young man, 23 years old. I was 16. And he'd always tip me and laugh and talk, and he wouldn't let anybody shine his shoes but me. I came to my senses at that particular moment, and I turned around, gave the gun to Abe, and I said, here, I'm not going to have anything to do with you guys. And I left. I ran down the road as fast as I could go. And it was dark that night. I stumbled and fell, but I had run about two or three blocks away from the scene of the crime when I heard some shots said, bang, 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 just like that. And I had been foolish, I know, but I had not been trained to be an insane person. I was not about to go back there to see who was shooting who. So I kept on running until I got home. And when I got home, my mother was standing up. She was sitting up waiting for us. She never went to bed unless all her children were accounted for. When she opened the door, I stood there sweating and panting like a horse that had been in a race.
She knew something was wrong.
Yes, the way I was gasping for breath and everything, and the look in my eyes. You know, a mother can look at her offspring and tell when something's wrong by looking into their eyes. She knew something was wrong. She asked me, what's the matter? Are you in some kind of trouble? I said, no, Mom, I've been playing football over in old man Henderson's field with the boys. She knew I was lying. She said, go on upstairs and go to bed. I'll talk to you in the morning.
Now, the police arrived at your house in the middle of the night, banged on the door.
Yes.
Came and dragged you out of the house. Mm-hmm. What did they say you had done?
When they awakened me upstairs after Mother let them into the house, they came upstairs and pulled the sheets back off me where I had tried to hide myself, but I could still feel the beams of their flashlights coming through the sheet. And they pulled the covered back and told me to get up and put my clothes on. I got up and put my clothes on very shakingly, tremblingly, and one of the police said, have you told your mother what you and those boys done tonight? I said, no, I haven't done anything. And he said, the hell you haven't. Said you went out here and you shot a white man and you raped a white woman. And I said, oh, no, I don't know anything about that. And they said, come on, the chief wants to see you. So they took me downstairs, and downstairs my mother was having fits. She was acting like a crazy woman. She was saying, what has my boy done? Lord, have mercy, forgive me, help me. Jesus, what has my boy done? She was telling the police that he's my only son. Please don't take him. What has he done? Take me instead of him. Mm. And when I look back at it now, and I see my mother standing there in the doorway, wringing her hands and telling the police to take her instead of me. I can never forget that. It just comes back to me all at once.
Well, certainly the way you're talking about it, it sounds almost as like you're reliving it, that the memory and the details are so powerful.
They are powerful. When a traumatic event happens like that to a young person, or even to an older person, it makes an indelible imprint on the mind.
Now, you were taken over to the police station and interrogated there. Describe what the interrogation process was like.
Well, the police station interrogation process was nothing at all. All they asked me was my name and address and where I lived. That was what the sergeant asked me in the booking room there at the police station. But outside the police station, on a flagpole, was the shirt of the victim who had been shot. The white man who had been shot, his bloody shirt was hanging on the flagpole of police headquarters there in Marion, Indiana, for the whole city to see.
And that was a kind of a flag, a call to action.
Yes, kind of a waving a flag in front of a bull, waving a red flag in front of a bull, that's what you might call it. And after they got to ask me these few questions in the booking room there at police headquarters, they allowed me to go into a room where the sheriff was sitting down at his desk. And when I went in that room, the sheriff told me to have a seat, and I had a seat. He said, do you know Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith? I said, yeah. He said, well, you with him tonight? I said, yeah, I was with him for a little while. And he said, where'd you boys go? What'd you do? How'd you meet him? And I told him all about how I'd met Abram Smith and Thomas Shipp that night at a place where we were pitching horseshoes, and I was ready to go home, and they offered me a ride. And he says, anything happened while you was in the car? And I said, yeah. I said, Abram said they wanted to hold up somebody and get some money to buy a new automobile. And I told him I didn't want to have anything to do with anything like that, so I tried to get out of the car, but they wouldn't stop the car. And the sheriff said, why wouldn't they stop the car? I said, I don't know. They kept on driving. So he said, what happened when you got out into Lover's Lane? I said, well, we went through a dark thicket part of the brush, and we came upon a car that was parked on the road. And I said, they told me to go and hold the people up, and I told them that I was scared to hold the people up because what if the people in the car had a gun? And they said, oh, no, they haven't got a gun. So we'll stand over here on the side, and we'll make out like we got a gun, too. So very foolishly, I took the gun, and I walked up to the car, and I said, stick them up. And that's when the man and the woman got out of the car.
Did the sheriff believe you?
He did not believe me, no. No, he didn't believe me. The police pounced on me and almost tried to kill me right there. Then after they tried to kill me and didn't succeed in doing that, they grabbed me and threw me in the chair alongside the desk where I had been sitting and talking to the sheriff. And then the sheriff put a piece of paper in front of me, and he says, here, sign this. Well, my mother had always told us to always look at something before we sign it to see what we were signing. So foolishly, I looked over and tried to read what the sheriff had written down on the paper, and one of those policemen hit me upside the head. It felt like a wrecking ball up against a building somewhere. I saw a million stars. He knocked me out of my seat, and I hit the floor. They snatched me back up and threw me in the chair and said, damn it, the sheriff said, sign it, not read it.
So what did that piece of paper say? What did you sign?
I didn't find out what it said until a year later when I had my trial. It said that Thomas Shipp had killed the man and that Abram had raped the woman. But the thing of it is, at my trial a year later, the woman said she hadn't been raped. That was why the judge repudiated the conversation and threw it out.
Now, after this interrogation, you were locked up in the jail. When did you notice a crowd begin to gather around the jail?
The very next morning, when daylight approached. See, I'd been arrested on the evening of August the 6th, 1930. And by the time they put me in jail, it was around 2 a.m. And when they put me in this jail, I was in there about 3 hours from 2 to 5 talking to the men that were in the cell block where I was incarcerated, because they all crowded around me and wanted to know what was the matter and what had I been arrested for and what had I done and all that. So I told them the same thing I told the sheriff. I didn't know anything about I should have kept my mouth shut or nothing like that, you know. And when I got through telling my story, they said, oh, hell, I wish I was out of this here place. Because there was 30 black men in there who had been caught riding the train through Marion, and they had been given 30 days for vagrancy in the city of Marion, Indiana.
Now, when this crowd began to gather, did they have signs? Were they shouting things up to the jail?
No, they were just shaking fists up at the jail and looking at the windows and everything like that. And they were gathering in small knots of people, 8 to 10 people at a time, and the crowds kept getting bigger and bigger all during the day.
We'll continue with James Cameron's story after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to guest host Marty Moscawen's interview with James Cameron, recorded in 1994. He died earlier this week at the age of 92. When we left off, he was telling the story of how he was nearly lynched at the age of 16, accused of a rape and murder he did not commit. An ugly mob had gathered outside the jail where he and his friends, Thomas Shipp and Abraham Smith, were held.
Now, this crowd broke into the jail. They took Smith and they took Shipp first before they got to you.
I was a cleanup target.
You watched them drag these two men from the jail. What did you see?
I saw them beat him unmercifully. They beat Tommy first. The amazing thing is they took Tommy out of his jail cell block, beat him to death right there in front of my eyes, and then they drug him around to the side of the jail and hung him on the barred windows of the cell block where Abram was incarcerated. And no doubt Abram was looking out the window and seeing them hang Tommy on the windows of his cell block.
You knew that Tommy was dead?
Oh, yes. We knew that Tommy was dead when they drug him out of sight because someone had ran a crowbar through him several times.
Now, you said you watched him knowing that you were the third person in this group. You watched knowing that you were next?
No, I wasn't next at that time. After they got through hanging Tommy on the window, they came back and got Abe out and hung him. And then they came back and took Tommy down from the jail window where they'd hung him and drug him through the streets like a dead horse. These 16 and 17-year-old white boys did that. And they drug him up to the courthouse tree and hung him alongside of Abe. And after 15 or 20 minutes of having their pictures taken and everything beside the two bodies that were hanging on the trees, they came back to get me.
And you describe hearing the chants, "We want Cameron,
Cameron." That was the second time after they failed to get me the first time. The first time they came up to the jail after they had hung Abe and Tommy on the tree, they came back up to the jail and they told us to divide ourselves and get on each side of the cell block. So about 15 or 20 blacks got on one side of the cell block, and 10 blacks and these 4 whites got on the other side of the cell block, and the mob came in and said, "Cameron is in here." I said, "Where is he?" Now, in these 30 men who had been caught riding a train through Marion and given 30 days in jail for vagrancy, one of those men had a 16-year-old son, and he was my age, my height, my complexion. We could have passed for twin brothers, so much did we look alike. Well, at any rate, the mob was questioning this young kid and asked him his name. He told him his name was Charles Haynes, and they asked me my name, and I told them my name was Henry Burton. I wasn't about to tell them my name was James Cameron after I'd seen what they'd done to Tommy and Abe. So just then the sheriff came in, and he told the mob leader, said, "Come on, let's get the hell out of here." So you've already hung 2 of them, so that ought to satisfy you. And then the mob turned around and went back down. upstairs, and they told this 15,000 to 20,000 people out there waiting for my presence that Cameron's not in there. And they said, yes, he is, and we want him. And then they began to yell for me like a favorite basketball or football player. They said, we want Cameron, we want Cameron, we want Cameron. And I thought I would die.
Mm. Well, they did identify you and dragged you from your cell. You describe people beating on you, mm-hmm. Children spitting on you as you were dragged outside.
And as the police cleared the path through the mob so I could get up to the tree, which was just one block away from the jail where Tom and Abe were hanging, as the police cleared the path, I looked over into the faces of people as they were beating me along the way up to the tree. I was pleading for some kind of mercy, looking for a kind face, but I could find none. And they got me up to the tree, and someone said, where's the rope? They got a rope, and they put it around my neck, and they began to push me under the tree. And that's when I prayed to God. I said, Lord, have mercy and forgive me my sins.
Now, I'm sure you've been asked this before, but what were the thoughts that moment before you thought you were going to be hanged?
Well, I was ready to die. I wanted to leave a world full of so many false and deceitful people. I was ready to die.
But you heard a voice. What did the voice say?
The voice said, take this boy back. He had nothing to do with any killing.
Did anyone else in that crowd hear that voice?
No. 4 years later, after 1 year awaiting trial and then 4 years in prison, I came back to Marion, Indiana, and I asked people, and they said, you were just lucky we didn't hear any voice.
Mm. So the crowd, the frenzy of the crowd died down?
Oh, yes, in an instant. And no human voice, honest to God, could have quelled the fury of that mob that night. It had to be a miraculous intervention.
And the crowd literally parted as you stumbled then back to the police station.
Yes, half a block away. And the sheriff was out there, and he said, I'm going to try to get you out of here for safekeeping. Well, hell, it was too late for that. The decent-loving white people and blacks had been calling him up all morning, telling him to get us out of there and take us down to Indianapolis for safekeeping. But he wouldn't do it. Of course, I found out later after I got out of prison, and I went back and started questioning people about it, reading all the newspaper accounts and everything, and then from what I could remember myself. So I wrote a book about it, A Time of Terror.
And once you were released from prison, you went back and interviewed people that might have been there knew were there?
That I hoped I might find somebody was there, and I did. I found a lot of people.
Did you find people wanted to talk about the lynching?
Yes, and I found some that didn't want to talk about it.
You also write that while you were in prison, a number of people, both black and white, came to the prison to apologize for what happened.
Yes, you'd be surprised. I was really surprised. So many white people came and apologized, and they were sorry and all that.
Was that enough?
It wasn't enough, but it helped.
Mm-hmm. Now, where did you get the idea for the Black Holocaust Museum, which is now in Milwaukee?
My wife and I were traveling several years ago, in 1979 to be exact, and we visited the Jewish Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. And when I came out of there, I was so emotionally disturbed I couldn't hardly talk. But I told my wife, I said, honey, we need a museum like this in America to show what had happened to us black people and freedom-loving white people who've been trying to help us in our fight for equality in this country.
Now, where do you get the artifacts and what kinds of
Send them to me. People send me artifacts. They look up in their closets or in their trunks and find descriptions of lynchings and pictures of lynchings. They find books about black and white people that they haven't used for years, and they send them to me. Even white people send me things. I have Ku Klux Klan robes and skulls, you know, gold skulls that they use for tie pins or lapel button. Wallets and belt buckles and a whole bunch of stuff.
You were pardoned by the governor of Indiana last year in 1993, the state saying that they had forgiven you.
Yes.
Do you forgive the state?
Yes, I did. You should read my acceptance speech that's in my book, A Time of Terror. They have an appendix in there, the speech I made when I accepted this pardon that Governor Edward Evan Bayh had so graciously bestowed upon me. I I told them that since Indiana had forgiven me, I in turn forgive Indiana for their indiscretions.
Well, I thank you very much, James Cameron, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
James Cameron speaking with guest host Marty Moscawen in 1994. Cameron died Sunday at the age of 92. His book, A Time of Terror, is currently out of print. Coming up, reviews of the films Lake House and Nacho Libre. This is Fresh Air. Summer begins officially next week, but film critic David Edelstein says two new movies opening today offer just the kind of escapist entertainment we expect this time of year. The Lake House is a love story that reunites Speed co-stars Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock in a time travel romance. The other film, Nacho Libre, stars Jack Black as a masked Mexican wrestling hero.
Romantic time travel fantasies are the refuge of fools who'd rather dream of ways to rewrite the past than to solve their problems in the present. And like most people, I'm a total sucker for them. I even love one of the dumbest, The Lake House, in which architect Keanu Reeves and chief hospital resident Sandra Bullock share an isolated retreat outside Chicago, 2 years apart. And for some reason, the filmmakers never even bother to cite sunspots or Indian burial grounds. They end up being able to mail each other letters. Down goes the red arm on the mailbox, and up bubbles another missive from the past or future. Keanu in 2004 asks, "Is it different in 2006? And Sandra says, "Oh, it's pretty much the same." And you wonder what planet she's on. Iraq? Katrina? The tsunami? You can see the climactic revelation limping its way toward you about 90 minutes before the nearsighted heroine does, but who cares? As they proved in Speed, Keanu and Sandra have so much chemistry, you happily wait for them to overcome their daunting temporal hurdles. She's all perky self-deprecation, and she has better hair than in years. It frames her face like it did on that runaway bus. And his peculiar combination of engagement and beautiful blankness appears to be ageless. After my screening, an older gentleman peppered a publicity assistant with questions of logic while the poor young woman stared into the middle distance. What could she say? The movie makes no sense. Really, folks, there are ways to fry your synapses that are much more fun than trying to diagram time travel romances. As the Buddhists might say about the river that is time, just go with the flow. And then go see Nacho Libre, which is even more entertainingly ridiculous. It's directed by Jared Hess of Napoleon Dynamite, the deadpan story of a stringy Idaho mouth breather with eyes at a perpetual half-mast. I'm not sure why, but this zombie comedy became a sort of teen anthem. This time, Hess has a truly dynamic Napoleon in Jack Black as Ignacio, Nacho for short, an apprentice Mexican orphanage friar turned masked wrestler. Deadpan does wonders for Black, who's sometimes so extroverted he gets tedious. Here, he's piously immobile, but with a devilish glint in his eyes, and he's given to striking would-be heartthrob poses and erupting into American Idol-style crooning. That is, he's given to explosions of Jack Blackness. The crazy slapstick headbanger wrestling matches are another good outlet for his talents, like this battle in an alley between Nacho and a skeletal street kid known as Esquilito, played by Hector Jimenez, who steals day-old tortilla chips meant for the orphans and who proves unusually limber.
Listen to me. Today, I have the chance of a lifetime. But first, I need a man.
Get off me!
Don't you see? Your skills plus my skills in the ring. Tag team.
You're crazy. Aren't you tired of getting dirt kicked in your face? Don't you want a little taste of the glory? See what it tastes like. No.
If we win, we get 200 pesos.
Nacho Libre is semi-infantile camp, and there are one too many fart jokes. But it's also gorgeous, with pop-out reds and electric blues in the purposely cheesy wrestling scenes, which summon up an era of superhero Mexican wrestlers like Santo and the Blue Demon. As in Napoleon Dynamite, Hess puts his characters in the center of the frame to make them look more awkward, only this time behind them are storybook Mexican vistas. It's a surreal fairy tale. Black's Nacho makes moo cow eyes at the pure, breathtaking Sister Encarnacion, embodied by Ana de la Reguera, and his accent is forever slipping from the Frido Bandito to Maurice Chevalier to, I think, Slobodan Milosevic. He curls his eyebrows, he twitches his manly buttocks, and he leaps into the ring with a belly that might have been designed for bouncing off ropes. He makes you want to holler, Viva Nacho! Viva la estupidez!
David Edelstein is TV critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from the Everett Foundation in support of Consumer Reports, serving consumers through product testing and reporting for 70 years at consumerreports.org. From GM, working to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions with vehicles that run on gasoline or E85 ethanol. Details at livegreengoyellow.com. And from Picture House, presenting the Robert Altman film A Prairie Home Companion, with a cast that includes Garrison Keillor, Meryl Streep, and Lily Tomlin, now in theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, A Letter to a Godchild becomes a meditation on faith and religion. We talk with writer Reynolds Price. Also, The Fiery Furnaces have a new CD. We'll meet the brother-sister act. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Come away. Teach me, sweetheart. Come on, pal.